The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. And for the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the News and Observer and a magazine called Eating Well. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, I want to remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. On to Armchair Traveler today, we're going to begin our journey by exploring why some commonly visited sites are disappearing in rural communities. And I've seen this firsthand in North Carolina, and I'll have more on that a little later. But the headline reads, Rural America is Losing Its Pharmacies. This was written by Markian Herluck as a special to the Washington Post and was published in the November 11, 2021 issue of the News and Observer. So let's find out what's going on as we check out this trend that's taking place. Batson's Drugstore seems like a throwback to a simpler time. The independently owned pharmacy in Howard, Kansas still runs an old-fashioned soda counter and hand-dips ice cream. I bet that brings back memories to some folks. But the drugstore, the only one in the entire county, teeters on the edge between nostalgia and extinction. Julie Perkins, pharmacist and owner of Batson's, graduated from the local high school and returned after pharmacy school to buy the drugstore more than two decades ago. She and her husband bought the grocery store next door in 2006 to help diversify revenue and put the pharmacy on firmer footing. But with the pandemic exacerbating the competitive pressures from large local retail chains, which can operate at lower prices, and from pharmaceutical middlemen, which can impose high fees retroactively, Perkins wonders how long her business can remain viable. She worries about what will happen to her customers if she can't keep the pharmacy running. Elk County, population 2,500, has no hospital and only a couple of doctors, so residents must travel more than an hour to Wichita for anything beyond primary care. That's why I hang on, Perkins said. These people have relied on the store from way before I was even here. Corner pharmacies, once widespread in large cities and rural hamlets alike, are disappearing from many areas of the country, leaving an estimated 41 million Americans in what are known as drugstore deserts, without easy access to pharmacies. An analysis by GoodRx, an online drug price comparison tool, found that 12% of Americans have to drive more than 15 minutes to reach the closest pharmacy or don't have enough pharmacies nearby to meet demand. That includes majorities of people in more than 40% of counties. Now, In talking about this, it says from 2003 to 2018, 1,231 of the nation's 7,624 independent rural pharmacies closed. And that's according to the University of Iowa's Rural Policy Research Institute, leaving 630 communities with no independent or chain retail drugstores. So that gives you kind of a overall picture of what's happening. Now, independent pharmacies are struggling due to the vertical integration, as they call it, among drugstore chains, insurance companies, and pharmaceutical benefit managers, which gives these companies market power that community drugstores cannot match. Insurers also have ratcheted down what they will pay for prescription drugs, squeezing margins to levels that pharmacists call unsustainable. As the insurers' drug plans steered patients to their affiliated drugstores, independent shops watch their customers drift away. They find themselves at the mercy of pharmaceutical middlemen who draw a rather clawback pharmacy revenue through retroactive fees and aggressive audits, leaving local pharmacists unsure if they'll end the year in the black. That has a direct impact on customers, particularly older ones, who face higher copays for prescription medications if they have a drug plan, and higher list prices if they don't. If their local pharmacy can't survive, they may be forced to travel long distances to the nearest drugstore or endure waits to get their prescriptions from understaffed pharmacies serving more and more patients. Living in an area with low pharmacy density would increase wait times, decrease supply, and make it harder to shop around for a prescription medication, said Tori Marsh. That's GoodRx's lead researcher on the drugstore desert study. The financial pressures on independent drugstores began mounting 2 decades ago when Medicare instituted its Part D program using private insurance plans. Pharmacies' most frequent customers went from paying cash for list prices to using insurance coverage that paid lower negotiated rates. Independent pharmacies saw their margins shrink. On average, a pharmacy's cost of dispensing a single prescription, factoring in labor, rent, utilities, and other overhead, ranges from $9 to $15, but the reimbursement is often far less. Multiple pharmacists said that about half of a drug plan reimbursements fail to cover the cost of drugs and their overhead. What you're left with is 50% of claims that you can make some money on, and really the tiny percentage of claims where you make an extremely high amount of money, said Nate Hux, who owns the independent pharmacy in Pickerington, Ohio. It's that tiny sliver of wildly overpaid drugs, especially generics, that determines whether a pharmacy can survive. A generic drug that costs $4 might get reimbursed by a drug plan at $4,000. Filling a generic prescription from a financial standpoint is like pulling the slots at a casino, said Ben Jolly, an independent pharmacist in Salt Lake City. Sometimes you lose a quarter, sometimes you lose a buck, and sometimes you make $500, but you have to have those prescriptions that you make $500 on to make up for the losses on the rest of your meds. Some pharmacies increase their list prices to ensure they capture the highest reimbursements that drug plans are willing to pay, but that raises prices for patients paying cash. Jolly, who also works as a consultant for pharmacies across the country, said some pharmacists game the system by billing excessive charges for drugs they mix on site or calling physicians to switch patients to more profitable drugs. Pharmacies that play this game get exceptionally wealthy, he said. Most pharmacies either don't feel comfortable playing this game or aren't aware that that's how the system works, so they get left behind. That's why you see all these pharmacies closing, he said. Pharmacy benefit managers, middlemen known as PBMs, also steer customers away from independent pharmacies to affiliated chain mail order or specialty pharmacies with lower out-of-pocket cost. Some PBMs prevent local pharmacies from offering the most expensive drugs at all. The benefit managers counter that there are more independent pharmacies today than there were 10 years ago. An analysis conducted on behalf of the Pharmaceutical Care Management Association, a trade group that represents pharmacy benefit managers, showed a 13% increase in the number of independently owned pharmacies from 2010 to 2019. However, many of those new stores opened in communities that already had pharmacies. PBMs are not seeking to put independent pharmacies out of business, said Greg Lopes, a spokesperson for the trade group. PBMs are trying and often succeeding in lowering drug costs, he added. The insurers trade group, America's Health Insurance Plans, declined to comment. Katie Kazaria, a spokesperson for the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, an industry group representing drug makers, said the large market power of PBMs can leave patients with fewer choices. The system might work well for health plans and these middlemen, but it creates difficult access barriers for vulnerable patients, Kazaria said. We're concerned about the emerging issue of pharmacy deserts, where patients, particularly among communities of color, cannot readily access a community pharmacy for their medications. Independent pharmacists routinely identify those middle manager companies as the leading cause of their troubles. At Batson's drugstore back in rural Kansas, Perkins recently had a customer who had been taking Emgality, an injectable monoclonal antibody treatment for migraines made by Eli Lilly and Company, that typically sells for up to $760 a month. But the customer's drug plan wouldn't pay Batson's to fill it, forcing her to wait until it could be mailed from a specialty pharmacy. Frustratingly, Perkins said, patients who get pushed to order drugs by mail often bring them to her when they need help deciphering how to use them. Even when pharmacies make money on a prescription, there's no guarantee they can keep much of the profit. Drug plans charge pharmacy fees every time they need to interact with the PBM's claims database. While those fees average only 10 to 15 cents per transaction, a busy pharmacy might need to check the database hundreds of times a day. PBMs also have implemented retroactive fees based on performance metrics they set. Pharmacies can wind up losing money on a prescription filled months earlier. PBMs describe these as quality measures, but pharmacists complain they are more about sales volume. Many of the metrics track how diligently patients take their medication, which pharmacies can hardly control. One PBM's contact obtained by Axios showed only 1% of pharmacies were able to avoid retroactive fees. Jeff Olson, who owns three rural pharmacies in Iowa, said he paid $52,000 in retroactive fees and revenue of $6 million in 2015. While his annual revenue have remained flat through 2020, those retroactive fees last year totaled $225,000. That's money that can't be used for payroll, that can't be used to add those other services that your community needs, Olson said. Moreover, Olson said he doesn't know what metrics insurance plans use to evaluate his performance and calculate the fees. They define quality themselves, said Ronna Hauser, a vice president of pharmacy affairs for the National Community Pharmacists Association. If you have 20 Part D plans you contract with, that's 20 different quality programs that you're supposed to be aware of and keep up with. According to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, such retroactive fees were 915 times as high as 2019 as in 2010. The resulting higher prices mean Medicare beneficiaries burn through their initial coverage period faster and enter a coverage gap, or what is called the donut hole, sooner. At Olson's Pharmacy in St. Charles, Iowa, a town of fewer than 1,000 people, fees and other financial pressures forced Olson to scale back and operate the store as a telepharmacy. Technicians filled prescriptions under the eye of an off-site pharmacist, and customers see a pharmacist only one day a week. For a town with no other health provider or health care provider, that means 6 days when no one can provide vaccinations or tests for strep throat. Back in Howard, Debbie Lane, 70, likes the personal service Perkins offers at Batson's. It's a lot easier to go down to a local store, and if it happens to be after hours or an emergency, she'll open up for us, Lane said. Perkins will tell her that if Lane can save money by driving to a chain drugstore in Wichita instead, and recently Perkins ran the numbers to help Lane decide which Medicare plan would be the least expensive given the medication she takes. Lane knows it's a struggle to keep a small-town pharmacy open and fears what might happen if Batson's closed. It'd be devastating, Lane said. There are a lot of us, like me, who will sometimes pay a little extra to make sure that Julie stays in business. And kind of an interesting report there, and granted it was a lot of detail about how pharmacies work, but again, the headline talking about the disappearance of rural pharmacies. And that brings to mind a story. When I was traveling in eastern North Carolina for my job back then a few years ago, I saw a lot of boarded up stores in the downtown areas of small towns that I would pass through. And among the stores closed were locally owned pharmacies. Also left empty were former hardware and furniture stores and even the homes of no longer published small town newspapers. And as the article we just read explains, much of the change is the result of changes in the local economy and the impact of large retail economies. Some of that could be attributed to a rather startling statistic from a survey done by a bank in the late 1980s. Now, this survey looked at population shift, and it covered much of eastern North Carolina, and it found that for every 3 young people, college age, leaving a county to go to school or for other employment, only one would ever return to stay at home. That number say a lot, doesn't it? It makes a big change. Well, next we're going to head to Hillsborough in Orange County, where writer Aaron Sanchez-Guerra reports on a historic home for sale in Hillsborough with a haunted past. Let's find out more about this. And this particular article, by the way, comes from the News and Observer, the October 31st edition. Dateline Hillsborough. In 1794, the Scottish immigrant James Hogg settled in present-day Orange County and built a home on land that once belonged to the Okanichi tribe. Nearly a century later, in 1891, Julian Shakespeare Carr, the Chapel Hill industrialist and notorious white supremacist, and his wife Nanny bought the home north of the Eno River. Now, 130 years later, the stately and historic Poplar Hill home in Hillsborough that sits on 1.96 acres at 209 Burnside Drive is up for sale, asking price $865,000. According to one of its recent residents, this 227-year-old home is as haunted as it gets. Well, that's going to kind of make things interesting, isn't it? Well, it says here in a first-hand essay in the magazine Bitter Southerner, writer Tom Maxwell described his brief tenancy there with his wife Brooke as thoroughly haunted. Eerie voices called them by name, and ghoulish apparitions tormented them in and around the house. Matt Johnson, who bought the home in 2020 with his wife Samantha to remodel and raise their children in, says the house has been quiet in his family's time there. "I don't know what the definition of haunted is," Johnson, 35, told the News and Observer, "but we haven't seen anything out of the ordinary. The house is fantastic. It's beautiful. It has that beautiful Southern traditional look." Ghosts aren't the only reason they're selling the home, but rather the trouble in finding the right design for renovating the house, and a preference for a location closer to their jobs and with another public school district, he said. Johnson said his family is in and out of the home, but they aren't in the house often because their main residence is elsewhere in town. The house does boast several beautiful characteristics: Greek Revival pillars, a brick stairway entrance and porch, French windows, 5 separate fireplaces, a long, shallow balcony, and original wide plank wood floors. The listing by Coldwell Banker HPW Realty describes the 4-bedroom, 2.5-bathroom home of 3,548 square feet as the 5th biggest property in downtown Hillsboro. It makes no mention of the house's history or any ghostly claims, but according to Zillow, North Carolina state law does not require a seller to disclose paranormal activity or if a death occurred on the property. And then they go into a second section titled Haunt of the Hillsboro Home. Bottles that flew off the shelves and shattered themselves alone. The sound of phantom vehicles pulling up on the gravel driveway and the entryway door creaking open. A dark figure that would come out of the chimney, the firebox, and crawl across the floor and appear next to me in bed, Brooks Maxwell told CBS 17 in 2019. These are some of the paranormal phenomena the couple and their daughter witnessed at the home before ending their lease early in 2015. In his 2016 essay in Bitter Southerner, Tom Maxwell, once the lead singer of the Chapel Hill-based 1990s band Squirrel Nut Zippers, alternates between writing about his family's experiences and the history surrounding the home. "We stood on the uneven brick waiting for our dog to pee," Maxwell wrote. "He suddenly strained the leash, pulling Brooke to the west side of the porch, near a dark little band of trees by the shed. Out of the black, a tan figure advanced. It had bowed legs and no head. It shimmied toward Brooks in a crotch, whipping its long, thin arms like tentacles. Then it receded back into the trees." Maxwell and his wife had been drawn to the house by its affordable rent and lush, deer-populated woods, but quickly found there were more unsettling things beyond its dark, colonial, and racist past. Ghosts appeared in the form of shadowy mist, and even a woman with a white bonnet and long brown dress walking outside the house, then disappearing. The Johnsons didn't have that experience. "There's nothing that we've really seen that's really been out of the ordinary or anything like that," Johnson said. "I kind of rather hate to sell it a little bit. We really wanted to fix it up." A previous tenant of the home lived there for a couple of years and had no paranormal experiences, and he shared with him and his wife, Johnson said. And now they go to another section called A Scary History. The home was visibly located near historic hunting ground and near markings of where the Okanichi tribe lived. Maxwell wrote, speculating that it may perhaps be literally built atop an Indian burial ground. Maxwell surmises that the haunts there may be accrued like emotional residue on the usurious intent of several owners. Its first owner, James Hogg, assisted in the colonial effort of taking land from Native Americans in North Carolina during the time that the pioneer Daniel Boone blazed the Wilderness Trail. After he died, his family lived there for around 90 years until the infamous Carr bought the home. Carr, a Confederate veteran, was a supporter of the Ku Klux Klan, who funded the 1913 creation of the now-toppled Silent Sam Confederate Monument on the campus of the University of North Carolina. In his dedication speech for the statue, he bragged about using a horsewhip to beat a black woman, a fact spoken of often by the protesters who eventually knocked the statue down in August 2018. The first renovation of the plain old farmhouse that Hogg built was commissioned by Carr as well, according to Maxwell. The troubling history didn't end there. In the 1980s, UNC anthropologists discovered the remains of an Okanichi community in graveside yards away from the house. It had the remains of children and young men who were killed violently. At one point, the home was included in a Hillsboro ghost tour, CBS 17 reported. For his part, Johnson and his wife were not made aware of the entirety of the history of the home and its previous owners. "I'm sorry to hear that. It's news to me," he said. "We knew that a fellow named Julian Carr lived here, but we never looked into all of the history." Kind of an interesting sidelight there as we travel over to Hillsboro, right? Well, from Hillsboro, we're going to head to the West Coast to savor the slow life on California's Central Coast. Now, this article was written by Betsy Andrews. It appeared in the June 2021 issue of Eating Well magazine. So let your appetite go wild here. You ready? Midway through breakfast, my traveling buddy, Chef Scott Clark, disappeared. We were on the deck at Hidden Kitchen Restaurant, a find in the California surfing community of Cayucos, devouring the house specialty, blue corn waffles. Mine was piled with savory toppings, organic avocado, fried eggs, beans, salsa. Frost Clark's 5-year-old daughter was demolishing a sweet one, her face smeared with coconut whipped cream. Around us locals, some fresh from the waves, were eating with equal gusto. But even the town's favorite breakfast couldn't keep a guy seated when he was determined to buy a boat. Clark, 34, and I were nearing the end of a 5-day journey with Frost and her mom, Alexis Liu, along the Central Coast, 350 miles north of tiny towns, small farms, and endless waves that stretches from just south of San Francisco to Ventura, north of Los Angeles. It's a sleepy part of California. Most drivers miss it, booking down the 101 freeway between cities. However, travelers who venture along the Highway 1, the Pacific Coast Highway, also called the PCH, the meandering, more picturesque road that hugs the shoreline, can sample its many charms. We had started the trip at Dad's Luncheonette, Clark's restaurant and his refuge, in Half Moon Bay, 30 miles south of San Francisco. There, in an old-time caboose, he whips local veggies and dairy into crave-worthy lunch fare. Seasonal herb salads, crispy mataki, mushroom sandwiches, icebox Earl Grey pie. Now, Clark had moved there in 2017 for a slower pace of life and wanted to show me his favorite spots in the region. So we hatched a plan to caravan down to the PCH. Clark could surf, and we'd eat all the good things along the way. At Harley Farm's Goat Dairy in Pescadero, a dusty farm town on the peninsula that shelters the San Francisco Bay, we sampled charvet that was sweet from the meadow grass and salty from the Pacific breeze. Farmer D. Harley, a British expat, settled here 35 years ago and married the heir to Duarte's Tavern, a town landmark founded in 1894, where the four of us stopped for a bite. Amid taxidermy and mounted fish, we spooned up creamy soup, vibrant with the flavor of the local crop, artichokes. As we traveled the Monterey Peninsula, on down through the Big Sur to the surfer towns of San Luis Obispo County and the pristine estuary of Morro Bay, we shared meals made with local ingredients and local pride. Crab Louis salad featuring junges pulled from the Pacific, mushroom curry with foraged fungi, and tangy Olala berry pie filled with fruit grown at the Lynn family orchard in Cambria. On a beach north of Cayucos, Spencer Marley, founder of the Marley Family Seaweeds, took us on one of his bespoke seaweed foraging trips. Scrambling through tide pools, we munched as we went, tender sea lettuce, meaty kombu, and Marley lit a camp stove and cooked seaweed ramen. "Are you stoked, kiddo?" Clark asked Frost. "I'm so stoked," he answered. "Me too," said Frost, slurping noodles against an orange sunset. Maybe it was there and then, as he and Marley traded fishing tips, or while kayaking in Morro Bay, or visiting its same-named oyster farm, but somewhere along the way, Clark decided he needed a boat. The tug of the ocean here was that compelling. After those morning waffles, Lou, Frost, and I took a stroll out onto Cayucos Pier to watch surfers and seabirds bob in the water. Eventually, we wandered back into town to a tiny multicolored shack at the foot of the pier that Clark calls his ignition point. Ruddle's Smokehouse, home to legendary smoked fish tacos. I had just ordered a mess of them, filled with albacore, ahi, and salmon and shrimp, dressed with aioli and snappy applesaw, when Clark rolled up in his truck, hauling a trailer, holding a banged-up skiff. It was a heck of a souvenir. Clark jumped out and took a seat at the picnic table where the rest of us sat with proprietor Kathleen Ruddle. "You're the reason that I have a restaurant," he told her. "This place changed the course of my life." The first time he had visited Ruddle's was in 2014 with Lou. At the time, Clark was a sous chef at a 3-starred Michelin restaurant in San Francisco, and he had wanted a fine dining experience. "But we ordered tacos, and sitting here I was like, oh, this is it," Clark said. Ruddle's husband, Jim, who founded the restaurant 20 years ago, had been his role model, Clark told her. She understood what he meant. Before his death in 2018, Jim's office had been the lawn chair facing the beach. His quality of life was so good that he wanted to keep it simple, Ruddle said. He just wanted to smoke fish and watch the ocean. So it is with Clark. When Lou got pregnant with Frost, Clark decided it was time to make a change. The Central Coast sea meets land vibe told him. Small farms where passionate people are doing their thing drew me, he said. Good people, good food, water everywhere. On the trip's final morning, Frost ran along paths blazed by shorebirds on Pismo State Beach. "Dad, I found a dinosaur track." "Dinosaurs? No way," Clark kept one eye on his daughter as he tended a small fire on the sand. I had asked what inspired him most on our journey, so he was showing me by cooking our send-off meal using ingredients picked up on our travels. Grilled Morro Bay oysters, dressed in mignonette deep with umami from shau and forage seaweed, and bright from farm-fresh citrus and pink peppercorns scavenged from a roadside bush. Seagulls stood staring at our shell pile as the shell pile grew. "Wow," I said, reaching for more oysters and for some surface slang I picked up on the trip. "This has been epic." Clark laughed. "There are so many gems to cover here," he said. "The Central Coast, as he puts it, is just joyful." Whoa. Boy, talking about fun, huh? Well, anyway, Betsy Andrews has some travel tips for you, and they're included with her article if you consider going to California's Central Coast. Let's take a look at some of the things she suggests. Places to stay for mod style and balcony views of Santa Cruz surface. You can check into what they call the Dream Inn. Yeah, you would expect that in California, huh? DreamInSantaCruz.com is where you find more information online. DreamInN, Santa Cruz, SantaCruz, DreamInSantaCruz.com. Then we have Carmel's Tally Ho Inn, and it offers big, gracious rooms with jacuzzis. And you can check that one out at tallyho-inn.com. Tallyho-inn.com. N spelled again, I-N-N. Luxury Lodge Whitewater is on Cambria's picturesque Moonstone Beach. WhitewaterCambria.com. Cambria is C-A-M-B-R-I-A. WhitewaterCambria.com. And then we have rooms that have outdoor hot tubs are found at Sycamore Mineral Springs Resort. This is in Avila Beach. Avila is A-V-I-L-A. Check it out at SycamoreSprings.com. SycamoreSprings.com if you want more information. Now, about places to eat, we have Dad's Luncheonette, that makes Half Moon Bay's best lunch. Dad'sLuncheonette.com will let you take a look at that menu and probably pictures of the food. Dad'sLuncheonette.com. You can dine on locally caught fish and vegetables from the restaurant's garden at Duarte's Tavern in Pescadero. DuarteStavern.com is where you find more information online. Duarte is spelled D-U-A-R-T-E and with an S. DuarteStavern.com. And my friends, that's going to bring us to the end of this edition of Armchair Traveler. We certainly hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be with us next time. I'm Mike Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, reminding you it is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Questions can be directed to 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening.